All them houses are floating around or have water in them, or some of them have even floated away.
Flooding worsens in Crooked Creek. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 10th of May. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, letting new technology make the case for ANWR drilling.
We don't get credit for the fact that the technology has advanced as it has over these decades.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Pennair, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
The dramatic flooding in Crooked Creek has worsened. A jam of Kuskokwim River ice has held a few miles below the village of Crooked Creek today, pushing more water and ice back into the village. Many are losing their homes. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
About 50 people have been evacuated to the nearby Donlin Creek gold mine site. Power in most of the village remains down.
Major disaster up there.
Peter Atchek is president of the volunteer group Bethel Search and Rescue. He monitors the Kuskokwim breakup every year with the Alaska State Troopers.
We've seen houses that were half underwater, and there were some other houses that were just the rooftops were showing. Some other houses were knocked off their foundation in a tilt position. There were some houses that were kind of floating around in the water, and there's ice piled up against a lot of these houses.
Basically, all buildings along the village's front street near the river are being destroyed by water.
And then in between the old village and the new site village, you know, on the high hill, all them houses in between are floating around or have water in them, or some of them have even floated away.
Atchek says there's even water up to the post office, which is way up on the hillside. The runway has remained in use, although a few hundred feet of it are underwater. Atchek and other helpers carefully boated around flooded houses to get a head count of people who are choosing to stay. He says about 8 or 9 said if it got worse, they could run up the nearby hill to higher ground. But Atchek says they're still in danger. He says when the ice jam does release, all the ice that is surrounding buildings will move out and move out fast.
There will be some ice movement against those houses and could quite possibly wipe out those houses. Nothing can withstand that kind of movement.
The jam that's causing so much problem here is basically 2 miles downstream from Crooked.
Eric Holloway is a hydrologist with the National Weather Service and part of the River Watch team. Along with him is Carl Edwards, an emergency management specialist with the state.
In talking with the locals, the impact to them is severe, and they are sad to see this. They're happy to be alive.
Edwards credits village president Evelyn Thomas with rallying residents to move to higher ground the night before the major flooding happened.
Evelyn Thomas, I feel, helped save a lot of lives.
Local air carrier Hagland Aviation is taking non-perishable donations to Crooked Creek residents for free. Atchek says they need everything.
It's everything that a human person will need, you know, clothing, food, little items of comfort, toothbrushes, toothpaste, you know, shampoo.
Atchek says some residents left their homes while water was pouring in. He says one young man even left without his shoes. He wears size 7.5. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
In contrast to the Kuskokwim breakup, has been fairly mellow on the Yukon River so far. The ice went out at Eagle over the weekend. 2 years ago, a historic ice jam and flood wiped out the city waterfront and nearby native village there. Longtime Eagle resident John Borg says this spring's gradual warm-up made for an uneventful breakup.
The temperatures cooperated considerably, so the ice had a chance to deteriorate. So when it got enough pressure, it pushed it on through, and we had no high water, no jams, and everybody breathed a big sigh of relief, and glad to see the summer, and glad to know that the river's not going to hurt anybody around here this year.
Borg says this summer we'll see additional work on a few of the many homes built to replace those washed away in the breakup flood 2 years ago. He says a new health clinic is also scheduled to go up in the Eagle Native Village. There was no disagreement at a hearing in Washington today that oil and gas drilling technology has advanced greatly in the decades since the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline was built. But whether it's advanced enough to drill in environmentally sensitive areas is still up for debate, APRN's Libby Casey reports.
When it comes to technology and the oil industry, the question is whether advancements should mean more drilling or just mean higher standards so there are fewer spills and better maintenance of the types of wells and pipes already in use. Senator Lisa Murkowski, the top Republican on the Energy Committee, which took Tuesday's testimony, touted technological advancements like directional or sideways drilling. She says that could be used to drill from Alaska's state lands to reach underneath the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Of course, this takes us back to what we discuss so often here and have for decades, and that's whether or not we can successfully move to open up portions of ANWR. Something that I feel very, very strongly about, and yet we don't get credit for the fact that the technology has advanced as it has over these decades.
Murkowski was backed up by Alaska's director of the Division of Oil and Gas, Kevin Banks. He testified that an ideal place to begin directional drilling for any crude that may lie below ANWR is the Sourdough Prospect, an area that has not yet been developed on nearby state lands.
We believe that there is some potential that the prospect itself could reach into the ANWR territory. So it's a logical spot to begin looking for producing oil. And extended reach drilling could certainly make quite an impact on being able to drill from there.
Banks says some of the biggest advancements in technology mean that wildcat wells or new drilling in an untapped area is less of a guessing game.
Current state-of-the-art seismic interpretation on the North Slope means that wildcat exploration has become much more successful. Better success rates for exploration wells means that fewer intrusions from these operations on the environment.
Another witness, Thomas Davis, a professor at the Colorado School of Mines, says wildcat wells used to only be successful 1 out of 8 times, but thanks to new 3D seismic technologies, that's improved to 1 out of 4. But the Energy Committee's guests were not unified in green lighting the oil industry. Engineer and Arctic Program Director for the Wilderness Society, Lois Epstein, says the benefits of directional drilling are being overblown. She says it gives lawmakers and the public the false impression that oil drilling can be done from a distance with no impact. She says there will still be a footprint somewhere above ground, and Epstein warned that directional drilling only goes so far. The longest sideways drilling paths reach up to 8 miles.
And it might also be perceived to mislead the public by implying that oil drilling in an area will be forever limited to the distance accessible via directional drilling. When oil production proceeds using directional drilling, there will be calls to expand the drilling to reach portions of the reservoirs not accessible via that approach. The bottom line with directional drilling is that it allows a region to become industrialized and adversely impacted to essentially the same extent as conventional drilling, including surface exploratory activities which can have long-term consequences.
Epstein says it is important for Alaska's economy and citizens that the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline, or TAPS, keeps operating with a steady flow of oil. But she says it's actually advancements in technology that will help it keep going. She says upgrades like heaters or liners can help, and she says there are reserves of oil yet to be tapped on state lands.
I want to emphasize that despite in-state and DC-based rhetoric, drilling on federal lands or waters is not necessary to ensure that TAPS remains viable for decades to come. And there's been quite a bit of testimony along those lines in the state legislature recently. From an Alaskan perspective, drilling on state lands generally provides far more revenue for the state than from federal lands, including Outer Continental Shelf drilling beyond 6 miles, where the state receives no revenue from leases.
The debates over whether to drill in the Arctic Refuge and off Alaska's coasts and how to keep oil flowing through the pipeline are expected to heat up in the coming weeks as the summer driving season approaches and Americans face soaring prices at the gas pump. Senator Murkowski says that's an incentive to develop more resources, but opponents say new drilling sites will take years to develop, so they won't provide short-term relief. And they say oil companies should use the leases, lands, and the technology they already have access to. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
The Alaska Mental Health Lands Trust's board of directors heard from the public today on whether or not to lease 18 square miles of property near Chicoloon to coal mining interests. The trust's board already voted to lease the land several years ago, but opposition from Chicoloon residents stopped that plan in 2007. Mike Franger, senior resource manager for the trust, says the trust's board of directors met this morning in Anchorage, and the coal lease question was only one item on the agenda. But Chicoloon residents are concerned about the trust's move. Kirby Spangler heads the Castle Mountain Coalition, which spearheaded the fight against the trust's coal lease sale plan 4 years ago.
The feelings haven't changed. People were overwhelmingly opposed to the lease the first time around, and that has not changed. What's different now is that there are other proposals for coal mining being floated in the Matanuska Valley, and there's opposition to all of them.
Spangler says the coalition wants to preserve the ecological integrity of the Matanuska River watershed.
And there were a number of members on the board who expressed some of the same concerns that that we have as residents of the valley. You know, one thing we want to do is just support those members of the board who are concerned about the impacts of the activity.
The trust's Franger says the board is looking at the potential for leasing the land for coal exploration, but there is no lease sale scheduled yet. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new cruise ship operator makes a dramatic entrance into the Alaskan market.
This is a fantastic corner of our world, and just to be this close to nature is, I don't know, it's just exhilarating.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com. And by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news for over 26 years from Alaska's business sector, government, and industries. Information and subscription online at akbizmag.com.
While legislators have waited for a capital projects budget since long before the end of the regular session last month, they now have two versions to deal with. The House Finance Committee and the Senate Finance Committee both approved versions of the budget today. The Senate version will likely head to the floor as early as tonight. House Committee Co-Chair Bill Stoltz says if the Senate version arrives in his committee tomorrow, that will be the version to head to the floor. The special session must end 1 week from tonight. Meanwhile, the Senate Finance Committee today unveiled a compromise bill extending the state's coastal management program for 6 years, while meeting more needs of the coastal communities who want stronger input into development projects in their areas. If the legislature doesn't extend the program, it will cease operations by July 1st. Finance Co-Chair Lyman Hoffman says he considers the changes to the program this year to be minor, but it sets up smoother review when it comes back up in 2017. And Lyman Hoffman says he wants the coastal communities to make the next set of changes when it comes up again.
That's what this whole process is about. Not what the governor wants, what the legislators want, what's going to work for Alaska. The board is going to hear from the coastal communities, and through them, I think we're going to get some strong direction of where we should go.
The Senate bill differs from one passed by the House last month in several key points. It does not let the governor replace at will the local appointees to the policy board. They may only be removed for cause. The committee held the bill today for more assurances that the administration and the House agree to the changes. Disney Cruise Line made its first trip to Alaska waters last week, making a stopover in Skagway on Friday. As KHNS reporter Tara Bicknell tells us, the local vendors experienced a new type of Alaska visitor as an onslaught of children disembarked from the ship.
The beginning of summer tourism season looked a little different to Skagway tour operators this year. Mickey and Minnie Mouse were among the first cruise ship passengers of the 2011 season, with Disney Cruise Line's ship Wonder making its first ever trip to the Northern Lynn Canal.
The latest thing, Disney ship, sis. They didn't come here last year.
It was also the first cruise ship of the year for Skagway. The Chilkat Valley will see passengers off the Disney ships after the Fast Ferry begins running between the two ports. The ship is not quite like other princesses, pearls, doms, and spirits that usually tie up. It's full of kids.
There's great kids clubs, different ages, 4 to 7 and then 7 to 10.
Heidi and Barry of Seattle took their first cruise ever with Disney because of Jeff.
Yeah, I actually just found this out today.
Their son, who is dramatically twirling in circles, slashing the air with a plastic sword that lights up.
I see Mickey, Minnie, Donald, Daisy, Goofy, and Stitch.
Disney officials on the ship say an Alaska cruise fits perfectly into their brand.
We are always focused on what is the story that we're telling. Is it compelling? Is it authentic?
The local tourism industry is bracing for a different kind of passenger from Disney cruises.
A lot of new rules for a lot of tour operators.
Tanya Carlson is Haines Tourism Director.
I think it's been interesting. I think it's going to be a learning curve on both ends, not only for people in Alaska, but I think for Disney operating Alaska. I don't think they know quite what's coming, possibly.
But not everyone is worried about kids on shore excursions.
I'm Carl Holtz. I'm the president of Disney Cruise Line.
Holtz said on Friday he doesn't usually do this, but really wanted to be on Disney's inaugural sailing to Alaska. Of course, Walt Disney Studios were years ahead of Disney Cruise Lines when they filmed White Fang in the early 1990s at a set that lives on as the Southeast Alaska State Fairgrounds in Haines.
We offer a unique product, and they've told us for years, Alaska, Alaska, Alaska. So it was a very easy decision.
He called the weather in the first few days of the trip interesting, but says this is some of the most incredible scenery he's ever seen. And as far as the dark side of Alaska's natural world goes,
we're not going to make up stories. We believe in authentic storytelling.
Remember that scene from Bambi, a Disney movie?
You know, when it comes to the food chain, those kinds of things, we don't dance around things, but people understand. I mean, my 5-year-old son certainly understood that the bear ate the rabbit and the rabbit ate something else, okay? But the fact of the matter is, it's a great educational opportunity.
Disney has 17 more Friday calls to Skagway with shore excursions to Haines, too. Disney Cruise Line's President Carl Holtz says he thinks Disney in Alaska will work out for the long term.
Oh, I absolutely do. Yeah. This is a fantastic corner of our world, and just to be this close to nature is, I don't know, it's just exhilarating.
In Skagway, I'm Tara Bicknell.
A red flag warning is in effect until tomorrow night throughout south-central Alaska for Anchorage, the Matanuska-Susitna Valley, and the western Kenai Peninsula. That means fire conditions are critical with low humidity and high winds. But overall, wildfire officials don't expect anything extreme this season. Fire Weather Program Manager at the Alaska Interagency Coordination Center, Heidi Strader, says La Nina, the cooling of South Pacific waters that's been affecting Alaska weather, figures into the fire forecast.
Right now, La Nina is moderating and kind of a more neutral state. And looking at similar years, we expect that between 700,000 and about 1 million acres will burn.
That's about normal for Alaska. Last year, 1.2 million acres went up, while 2.9 million burned in 2009. Strader says this summer is expected to be on the warm side, but that should be moderated by normal rainfall. She says long-range fire forecasting relies on comparison with years with similar trends, and there's always potential for surprise.
Weather can change quickly, and when it comes down to it, forecasting exactly what days the lightning will strike and where it will be, or where each rain shower is going to occur and how much rain it will bring, those are the tricky factors that always make our fire season a surprise.
Strader says ground factors like beetle kill on the Kenai and drought last fall in the upper Yukon and Yukon flats could contribute to increased early fire potential at those locations.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The only amphibian in Alaska is a climate indicator species, and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game wants to learn a lot more about it. The creature is the wood frog, and the state is recruiting citizens to listen for its delightful chirping. KDLG's Daisha Eaton has more.
That's the sound of the Alaska wood frog. And if that sounds familiar to you, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game wants to hear from you. David Tesler is the regional wildlife biologist for the Wildlife Diversity Program at ADF&G.
We would like people to submit any information they have on wood frog observations, and they can either submit just an observation of a frog they happened to see while they were out fishing or walking the dog or boating, or if they're interested in being more involved, we would love people to actually conduct listening surveys and listen for wood frogs calling in the spring as the after the ice melts out.
The Alaska wood frog is the only amphibian throughout most of the state. They range from the size of a dime to a couple of inches long, and they range in color from green to beige to pink, and they wear a mask.
They have one really unique characteristic is this dark band over their eyes, like a mask. They've been called the bandit frog because of it. So they've got this little bandit's mask on.
Besides being cute, the wood frog does something really cool. It freezes solid, then comes back to life.
They start to thaw out amazingly from the inside out. And frogs are cold-blooded animals, so it should not be possible that they generate heat. You'd think they would thaw as the surrounding environment thaws, or when sunlight hits the patch of ground they're in. But they start thawing internally. Their blood thaws and their heart starts pumping again. Their brain turns back on. They start breathing again. And they crawl out of their little hibernacula, their little burrow, and beat it towards the wetlands because it's time to breed again.
Besides that, it's the only amphibian north of the Arctic Circle, and it's a climate change indicator species. But Tesler says scientists really don't know that much about them. That's because they don't have enough staff to do the surveys that would tell them more. So they're recruiting citizens to help them out. Tesler explains what they're asking people to do.
Basically, you go to any wetland that has water, standing water, for at least part of the summer. Go out generally in the evening, but wood frogs in Alaska call it any time. And we ask folks to go out there and listen for 3 minutes. And let us know what you hear. Was there a frog or two calling? Was there some frogs calling? Or were there a mess of frogs calling? And it's pretty simple.
So after you settle down beside a local pond or puddle, you're listening for this. A few frogs calling, or this. Several frogs calling, or this. A whole chorus of them. If you'd like to do a wood frog survey, you can learn more at www.akfrogs.net. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Public Television's Nature Series is running a set of three shows featuring Alaska's bears, polar, brown, and black. Bears of the Last Frontier follows Seattle ecologist Chris Morgan to Kaktovik, Denali Park, the Noatak, Katmai, the Dalton Highway, and Anchorage as he seeks out the animals in their habitat. Cinematographer Joe Pontecorvo says the series is part of a larger effort to create a documentary about bears and their habitats all over the world called Bear Trek.
The idea behind Bear Trek is that it's a global motorcycle adventure. And we look at a number of rare species of bears that a lot of people never heard of, sun bears, which is the smallest of the bear species, and they're in Borneo, spectacle bears, which are like rock climbing bears that live in Peru, and they're all threatened, and their habitats as well. So we were looking at these bears as sort of icons, species, and indicator species for the habitats.
Some might consider it strange to use a motorcycle to explore bear country. The cameraman says he initially thought he had his doubts.
When Chris first brought up the idea of a motorcycle adventure around the world, I was a little skeptical. But then he told me this is what he used in the field for research all the time. This is how he got from A to B. And I was thought, okay, you know, you just like motorcycles. And then later on, we go to Borneo, and Wong, our sun bear biologist, has this little dirt bike he's riding around. That's how he gets from place to place. And the same with Robin Appleton in Peru. So actually, in the end, I was proven wrong that researchers do use motorcycles for bear research.
It took a year and a half to shoot the material used in the series, including one whole summer spent in Anchorage following fish and game biologists Rick Sinnott and Jesse Coltrane as they responded to bear incidents in the city. The crew also spent a lot of time in some of the same remote bays of Katmai National Park that were frequented by Timothy Treadwell, who was killed there along with his girlfriend by a brown bear in 2003. Treadwell, too, filmed himself getting close to bears and then showed his videos to the public. Viewers of their public television series have been quick to make comparisons, but Pontecorvo says Chris Morgan's approach is entirely different from Treadwell's.
One of the things that happens when you're in bear country for a long time, especially camping among them, is I think you can get complacent. You know, Treadwell was there longer than we were, and probably longer than most people. But, you know, I honestly think he got complacent.
Pontecorvo says it's a point of pride with Chris Morgan that he has never had to use his flares or his pepper spray, though other crew members have. Pontecorvo says they wanted to portray both the bears and their habitat. The reintroduction of predators to Yellowstone National Park has shown the world that predators are a key part of a healthy ecosystem.
If Yellowstone has proven anything, it's really shown how significant changes in the environment are, the things that take place, grasses that return, bird species that return, and it really has to do with putting that ecosystem back together as a whole. We really didn't know when we came into this country what we were doing when we started to extract species. We viewed them as predators, competing or injuring, you know, taking our cattle or competing with our food for food supply. And we began to eliminate them, and they turned out to be critical pieces of a very complex ecological puzzle.
Bears of the Last Frontier runs on PBS's Nature series on Sundays. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org or follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tara Bicknell in Skagway, and Daisha Eaton in Dillingham. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.